What is an entertainment zone? And are there different types?
Good question, Scott. The entertainment zone is an area of a city that outlived its original use and probably went through decades of decline and then experienced a rebirth over time, where entrepreneurs, nightlife entrepreneurs, entertainment entrepreneurs came in and rented or bought out spaces and set up bars and restaurants and cafes and nightclubs. And the district evolved from these individual actions. So it's the entertainment zone is not a place that's been formally designated by plan. It's not a place where the government ministry set up a large public-private partnership with a single developer. It's more of an organic thing in a place that suffered some measure of decline, maybe not a lot of decline, could in some cases a lot of decline, and organically it became an attractive place because of location, because of architectural oldness, because of a lot of reasons, because of price, where people could come in and inexpensively set up bars and nightclubs and restaurants.
I've also read a bit about these sorts of zones, but there's also, and in your work and the article that I read that you co-authored, it was a lot about kind of these smaller things, but there's also this sort of a bigger mega project kind of entertainment zone, right? So could you explain the difference between those two?
Yeah. I'm not sure if this is right. So the mega projects are very different. And in a way, they're easy to confuse. But the mega project is something in which the city or the economic development ministry of the city gets together with a private developer and says, we are going to redevelop this space, this part of the city, usually close to the downtown, as an entertainment center district destination. And we're going to have a movie, we're going to have restaurants, we're going to have bars, we're going to have a national and international retailer, say like Hard Rock Cafe, for instance, right? And there, we're going to set this up. But the differences vary when you look beyond the similarities on the surface. You get a lot of, you see a lot of differences. Like the entertainment zone is several owners, it's multiple owners. The entertainment district is one owner. The ED, the EZ, the entertainment zone, is something that sort of evolves organically over time with lots of small investments. An urban entertainment destination or district, in this case, is a developer-driven development that requires often hundreds of millions of dollars of public outlay initially. So even if there's lots of small spaces within the urban entertainment destination, the ultimate ownership lies with one company or one partnership. And it's not something that evolves over time. So it's more, in a way, the entertainment destination is more akin to a mall. And the entertainment zone is something that happens very organically on its own within the context of existing urban development, existing buildings and streets and so on. I'm going to turn this phone over to Brent a little bit for the next question.
Of course.
Does that work for you?
Okay. Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. So now, to give the listeners some historical background, when did these entertainment districts first start to appear in urban development?
That's an excellent question. A couple of ways you can answer that. You can look at the actual buildings in which the uses exist, and then you can look at the pattern of entertainment itself. The buildings themselves, it'll depend on how old the city is. So that will just be a question of the age of the urban fabric in the city. In most North American cities, when you had rapid growth at the turn of the century, you had a lot of growth occurring between, say, 1880 and 1920. So you often find that the buildings themselves tend to date from that age. The district we reviewed in Milwaukee in our paper is the older buildings are from that time. But the actual practice of entertainment occurring in small buildings in cities, we think is probably as old as the city itself. Certainly in European cities, you can document entertainment districts such as the area around Covent Garden in London that go back to the 17th and 16th century. Without getting into too much urban history, as soon as you started to have a consumer class with enough disposable income to spend on, say, a night out, and of course Paris was a famous example of that, you started to develop areas where entrepreneurs wanted to capture that money. So some of the earliest entertainment districts, per se, in North America were in large cities like New York, along Broadway, the Bowery, associated with uses like the theater, dance complexes, etc. They've changed over time. The ones that we found tend to be a little bit less entertainment-oriented per se, but you could find examples of live music and such occurring together with the more traditional restaurant and drinking uses. So entertainment is as old as the city itself, but certainly a proliferation of entertainment occurring beginning in the 18th century into the 19th.
All right, great. I think we'll go to the next question.
Sure.
Okay.
Hi, Scott. Dan again.
Hello. So these more organic entertainment zones or districts that you were talking about, how are they created? So what's the role? And what I mean by that is, what's the role of government? What's the role of private money in creating these sorts of smaller districts?
That's a great question. The role of government and private money. And this is something that we're all trying to still figure out, because we can go to pretty much any city in North America and find an area where these places exist. In Philadelphia, there's Old City and Delaware Waterfront and North South Street, and in Milwaukee's Water Street, and there's a half dozen within not too far from the Loop in Chicago, right? So these things are happening, and the question is, what is the role of government and what should it be? In this case, obviously the context of each city is going to be different, but the role of, say, the economic development and planning arms of government are to create dynamic conditions in which this sort of development might occur, right? So, mm-hmm. In a sense, it's the opposite of the way, at least American, I'm not an expert on Canadian cities, at least the way American cities do business. So American, if you walk into the city planning office or the economic development office of an American city, and Brett and I both used to work for New York City Department of City Planning, what you have is what they call the assemblage, and it's a map with a line drawn around several lots of property, and the idea is to assemble all the parcels, and the government helps the private developer do that to develop at a larger scale than what's existing, what was built, say, in 1850 or 1890 or 1920, right? So what the interesting thing about the entertainment zone is that the scale is actually much smaller than what anyone in planning and development thinks is possible, right? And here are entrepreneurs, and it happens to be entertainment, and entertainment drives, for better or for worse, drives a significant portion of urban economies in North America. The scale that this ecology works at is actually a very small scale, that these establishments fit into 20 or 30 feet of building frontage, right? So an entertainment establishment may be in an old building that's 25 feet wide by 100 feet deep, right? And they're found all over cities and warehouse districts and old downtowns on old sort of fading main streets and commercial areas. And entrepreneurs go in there and they make something of it with their own modest investments, right? So cities should be saying, how can we facilitate that? And how can we facilitate that in a way that it's not just about entertainment, it's just about good development, right? So the first lesson is that where you have older buildings, don't simply knock them down for something newer and better and bigger, that this is not necessarily the answer, that older North American districts latently have this value, this very urbane value, and the kind of urbanity that our colleagues in the planning and architecture world value, right? The sort of strolling on the street and the cafes. This is still possible even in places that don't look like there is lots of hope. And there will be, if you have small spaces, you allow for lots of developers, would-be developers, would-be entrepreneurs to actually get in the development game, right? So I think in a way we are trying to refocus the scale of development down to something that's manageable for a lot more players in this urban real estate game. I'm going to, Brett, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah. If he wants to comment, go right ahead.
I think Dan has captured it well. Essentially, what you find in cities is an ever-increasing scale of development, and that scale, no surprise, tends to be more appropriate for international or national scale developers. And when the average urban citizen looks at a very large scale development and then notes that most of the entertainment uses tend to be national or international chains, it's all sort of a piece, because the development problem has been defined as one that can only be solved by a very large scale development. What we proposed in the paper, and in a way it's extremely radical, is to say, what if we simply conceived of development occurring again at smaller scales that would allow for the participation of maybe local or regional developers? I suspect that you would then find that the uses, the entertainment uses that would inhabit those, would be much more local and characteristic of the region in their quality, as opposed to the large ESPN zone type uses that you find in the international and national scale development. So we directly link the physical scale of development with the kind of activity occurring in it, and argue that smaller scale that you find in a sense accidentally in the historic and older parts of the city is something that we need to think about happening in larger and new areas as well.
Yeah. Now, in talking about this development and how these as you talked about it, the smaller sort of entertainment zones, how they develop. So when you actually get these things created, these entertainment zones, so what did you find in your research that they contribute to a city? What do they contribute to the nightlife?
They contribute something very important on multiple levels. The first thing that they do is they provide an interesting place to go for the average urban citizen. And it's important to note that the entertainment zone is not necessarily something that contains uses that are of interest to every urban citizen. In other words, someone who is interested in the theater may not go to an entertainment zone and find that dollar beer specials are to their taste. On the other hand, to the great majority of suburbanites who are interested in, and it's not in a bad way, they're interested in an average entertainment experience, a kind of quotidian weekend experience, this kind of environment is extremely important. And we have to remember that most people, and this is true for both the United States and Canadian cities, live in a quasi or fully suburban environment, and they don't have necessarily a daily experience of what we would call the city. Old buildings, getting out of your car, walking, finding things that are a little bit different, kind of exciting, and that can mean any of the types of things you experience in the city. These districts, for better or for worse, are some of the major providers of that kind of experience. And we call that, for lack of a better word, we call it just a sense of oldness. It's an encounter with a larger range of timescales, because suburbia is often very new. So you come into an older part of the city, you're seeing old buildings, you're experiencing different people, you're getting out and walking. And then in your memory, you say, hey, the city's good for something, right? Even if you don't come into the city even for sport, and you don't come in for your work, you might come in for entertainment. And so we saw these little districts, extremely modest, filled with local people. These are not attractive to tourists necessarily. We saw these as very important indicators of vitality and meaning for the city in people's minds.
Yeah, so I mean, basically, it's a place where people can kind of rub shoulders with one another, in a sense.
Exactly, in the oldest and finest sense of what the city is for. Coming in, having a different experience. In our paper, we look at the term heterotopia, which is a term that comes from philosophy that Dan knows a lot about, which is about experiencing something different than the everyday. It's something other, something alternative. And again, for someone who is cosmopolitan and travels to Paris, going to downtown Winnipeg or downtown Milwaukee may not seem so exciting, but for the average suburban citizen, it's pretty different and pretty exciting. And so there's a populist streak to our research that says we should be thinking about designing cities for what the average person wants. Cities are not all about high-end museum and arts districts, nor are they only about social housing and solving the problems of the poor. They are about those things, but they're also about providing the average city dweller or suburbanite an experience of the city that's fulfilling and meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to go to the next question here.
Okay, I'll hand you back to Dan.
Okay, great.
Hi.
Hello. So now, in talking about, I mean, these as we're talking about these entertainment zones, I mean, it sounds very positive, but in your paper, you talk about how there's this, and I thought it was very interesting, that this paradox of how the urban establishment in a city views an entertainment zone. So could you explain that paradox?
I think part of the issue here is I think when we wrote this, and the idea in our own heads evolved over perhaps a decade, and published in 2008, but you can see where if you go back a decade, there was a lot of hostility towards, and there still is to this day, that this idea that there's parts of the cities that are out of control. In Britain, they call them no-go zones, right? Places where you don't want to go because there are people who are drunk, there are people who will do stupid things, there are people who will drink and drive. And none of the research that Brent and I have done in this we don't mean at all to suggest that these aren't significant problems. But there's also a compatibility, I think, with the entertainment zone. And I think you see it in Milwaukee that actually there was a combination of events that here you have these very, if you looked at a map of Milwaukee and you see where this entertainment zone is, it's just sort of to the west of where the downtown is. And there was a highway that ran along the top of the district, but these are they seem like throwaway buildings. But they've been, for a couple of decades now, they've been bars that people go, and their backs are to this little part of the Milwaukee River. It's actually quite pleasant. And they took this highway down in the north end, and with the entertainment zone running north to south, it actually created for Milwaukee, which is actually a very suburban city, very urbane conditions. So you actually had real property developers go and build like 15-story buildings there in that zone at the north end of that entertainment zone. So in a way, and you see this in Philadelphia, that's another entertainment zone that we've looked at quite extensively, that initially we thought that, you know, that these would be places that would be very isolated. They'd be close to the center of cities, but they'd be isolated either by a highway, by a waterfront, or train tracks, or a district of warehouses away from residential living. And the qualities of the entertainment zone would be something that urban establishment would say, well, you know, we don't want that kind of a thing here. You know, we don't want people to be stumbling into the street drunk. But if you looked at Old City Philadelphia and you looked at the real property values and you look at the fact that the condominium development is actually getting closer and closer to where the drinking establishments are, and actually in some spots are right on top of or next to, the entertainment zone is becoming an entree, as Brent was discussing, becoming an entree for the city for perhaps in some cases people who are uninitiated to urban living. And some of those people who are visiting the entertainment zone are actually buying or renting those residential properties that are nearby. So there actually is a compatibility here. And I think as cities sell themselves as places where you experience a lifestyle, these places are really important. And they're very fluid. So places are opening and closing all the time. So the fact that you have a whole bunch of bars doesn't necessarily mean that it'll always be bars, it'll always be a whole bunch of drunken fools on a weekend or watch a ball game. That the places change, and as the immediate clientele changes, they may become more sophisticated, or they may change their theme. They may become more compatible with people who have young kids, for instance. So, and then in that respect, we don't, you know, the idea is still evolving, and we're watching it, and we don't necessarily have the answers. So we were actually surprised when we saw that some of the new residential development in Milwaukee was advertising that their location was right at the heart of the Water Street entertainment zone.
How do these entertainment zones, once they're created, interact and affect commercial and residential space nearby?
Yeah, I think I'm not gonna let Brent answer this. I'll just say that I think that in terms of commercial space, the entertainment zone is a great thing. It catalyzes these spaces, and it makes the spaces in a larger area more viewable and brings more people into downtowns or near the downtown. So it's a catalyst, and then you can have other stores, regular sort of normal retail that happens in cities, happening around it. Any number of uses. Residential, I think, as I was saying, we're seeing a pattern now where we are seeing new residential development around these places, and I think these are the kinds of uses that people now are associating with cities. We don't have lots of big factories, and only a few cities have Fortune 500 headquarters and real property development, finance, and real estate. The fire that kind of a downtown, right? That there's only so much of that to go around, and cities can't sustain themselves based on that. So they have to have something more. Cities have become about consumption, and if they're going to be about consumption, then they have to market themselves to a very broad demographic, you know, and not just in a certain high-end niche, right? That this urban culture is not just about the opera and the theater and the art house and cinema, right? That it involves these other things, and some of them are quite quotidian, and some of them are things that maybe me or you don't want to do, but lots of people do, and it makes them dynamic, and it could be an entree to other things, other development, catalyzing other vacant or underutilized space. And I think developers, what we're seeing in places like Philadelphia, in places like Milwaukee, is that in Baltimore, developers are jumping on, and they're saying this is a good district because these places are there, because it has all these restaurants, because it has places where you can hang out at 12:30 at night. And they're building in these zones, and they're renovating in these zones, and that's what it should do. And I'm going to let Brent comment on that.
Of course, yeah.
The case that Dan was discussing, the Milwaukee case, is a pretty interesting one, not only because of how it seems to actually be catalyzing sort of higher-end residential development nearby. Of course, this is all with the proviso that our research was pre-2007, and the market has slowed down in many Midwestern cities, and I assume that's so in Central Canada as well. So there's a temporary slowdown that at some point will be regenerated, but that seems to be what was happening in Milwaukee. But the irony of it is that the very types of activities that were perhaps under discussion for being located in the entertainment zone were not actually physically compatible with an entertainment zone existing. So you can imagine that if a brand new apartment building is constructed, that building may either have no commercial use on the ground floor, or it may have a type of commercial use that the owner feels will bring in a sufficient amount of revenue, which is very unlikely to be, it need not be said, the types of uses that are found in entertainment zones. So we found the beginning of an interesting process that what we'd like to do is document this over time in more detail, where the entertainment zone actually seems to be potentially catalyzing the very types of uses that will then find at the entertainment zone incompatible, if that makes sense.
Wow.
In other words, the seeds of the entertainment zone's own destruction may be found in the very fact that it does enliven the city and add a lot of stimulation. And this is particularly the case in a lot of United States cities because, regrettably, the amount of urban fabric of small, older commercial buildings that can house stores on the ground floor that are in and adjacent to the downtown is relatively limited, because the 20th century was enormously destructive to such buildings. In the case of the Milwaukee example we looked at, the street, which is very modest, it's about four blocks, which is about 50% parking lots. It's facing on the opposite side of the street is all parking lots, because at some point the city decided they needed to widen the street, and they demolished every single building on the other side of the street. In addition, it's surrounded by the usual assortment of parking garages, as Dan mentioned, the freeway, larger office buildings, etc. So the risk is that these entertainment zones, which are so active and so vibrant, if they do actually catalyze additional commercial activity, that commercial activity may end up occupying the same space that the entertainment zone itself needs to thrive. So that's a potential risk that we identified at the end of the entertainment zone paper. We also found that the entertainment zone was not necessarily located at all in conjunction with previous retail revitalization efforts like a downtown shopping mall or a commercial revitalization. And this is because the downtown building stock of department stores and the like, not necessarily the kind of urban fabric that is appropriate for the entertainment zone. Although, the buildings are often too big and the ground floor spaces are too large. Although, that's not a hard and fast rule.
We also talked about at the start of the interview, we were just talking about more of these smaller sort of entertainment zones, but you said that, there's these bigger entertainment zones that are these kind of mega projects for downtown renewal. And you kind of touched on some of these things I kind of want to get into, is that some of the critics say that with these larger mega projects, what it basically does is create a monoculture downtown, essentially like plunking a mall in downtown. What are your thoughts on that argument?
Well, I'll start to answer this question, then I'll let Dan chime in as well, because I think we both have strong feelings on this. We feel very strongly that this type of development that you're referring to, which the Urban Land Institute in the United States calls the Urban Entertainment District, or UED, we feel that these districts are essentially large-scale corporatized simulacrums of the urban entertainment zone that we're interested in. And the benefits of these are the same benefits that attract mayors of large North American cities to be interested in things like convention centers and sports stadia, which is that they attract large national developers. They're sort of, we call them silver bullet projects, because the developer will claim that the project will solve the problem of downtown. They come with big dollars. Of course, they also cost big dollars. They come with very large subsidies at many times. And then when you look at them from a physical standpoint, they come with many of the same demands that a downtown shopping mall or associated project would come with, which is large amounts of parking, a large plot area, oftentimes several city blocks. And in fact, when you start to look at them at that scale, they're very, very different from the small-scale urban entertainment zones that we looked at, and I'll let Dan fill in some of the details on that.
Right. I think Brent said it very well. I think I'm just thinking all of a sudden I have Louisville in my head. And if you go to Louisville, there's a development called 4th Street Live. And it's not the biggest of these urban entertainment destinations, but it's two whole city blocks. And then it decks over the street, over 4th Street, and it's got a bunch of national retailers, including the Hard Rock Cafe, right?
Okay.
But if you go just to the north, to the south in Louisville, you'll find these other more organic districts that happen to make 4th Street Live, or to make Los Angeles Live, LA Live, which is the newest of these places that's opened recently. It takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of time, it takes lots of government people who work in planning and development, working on these projects and permissions, and probably hundreds of millions of dollars when it's all said and done. And you talk about the public property that's deeded over to developers or given off as a long-term lease. These things are expensive, they're very big, they don't fit with the existing scale of cities, And on the delivery end, the experience end is sort of a generic experience. And the entertainment zone, as opposed to the district or the destination, is something much more organic and homespun. And we're not economists, but we argue that lots of them, it takes very little, right? There's not a lot of government and public money risk. There's not a lot of public land that's been deeded over. And actually, because lots of the ownership, it's multiple ownerships and it's within, it's mostly local, that most of that money gets washed back into the local economy. So we feel very, very strongly that these are things that should not be pursued or be pursued in very limited fashion, and that allowing many people in your metropolitan area to be a part of the development world and to develop a smaller lot is something that cities should be encouraging rather than making deals with national developers.
Now, in talking about that, you know, and reading, well, I guess the criticism also comes up with these bigger ones. But I guess maybe it could also apply to some of these smaller things that, you know, downtowns and cities in general should simply just create space for people, not necessarily just be concerned about entertainment.
Right.
What is your thoughts on that kind of criticism?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You're talking about space for people, and here Brent and I, we've been actually discussing that before your call, and we wholeheartedly agree. The question is, how do you do that? And in an environment that, look, we live in cities where public money for purely public projects is scarce. And that's the reality of it. And we've been living through several decades in which now people who work in development offices are automatically trained to think of all development in terms of partnerships with for-profit developers or large institutions that are not-for-profit, and in a few cases, mostly for-profit developers. So nobody really wants to spend on the public realm. Nobody wants to spend on, there's not really a role in American cities anyway, and probably similarly so in Canadian cities, for simply government-created or government encouraged development without a subsidy. So the entertainment zone in a way is a way to sort of recapitalize. If you create the right conditions, you can recapitalize on one of the few assets that cities have over their suburban rings and potentially over other cities as well. If you have old building stock and old city fabric and old streets, that these buildings can be more than what they are today. And I think if you go, we joke around that every time you go to a different American city, and I think it's true, it's certainly true of the Canadian cities I've visited in Toronto and Montreal. You go there, you don't have to, you ask somebody, oh, where do I go to, where's the bar district? Where do I go? Where's a good place to go watch the game, right? I want to go watch the Maple Leafs, right? People will point you in the direction of that, whether it's Toronto, whether it's Louisville, whether it's Baltimore, even, you know, the Sun Belt, even Austin or Tampa, right? These places exist. So the question is sort of what is the role for the public sector? The public sector is not going to do urban development. It doesn't do that anymore and hasn't done it for some time. The entertainment zone, right, it's basically privately developed, but it's using the public infrastructure that's already there. So there's a good rationale for cities to encourage that. And right now, like I said, that I, you know, some of these, it's a fluid idea, the entertainment zone, and these spaces don't necessarily have to be about entertainment. They can evolve over time into something else. And maybe that's okay, and Brent and I are still trying to come to grips with that. And Brent said that, called it a risk, that as property values increase and people find this area desirable, that they may well want to move there, and it will attract other development capital. And all of a sudden, that your bar that has all the Baltimore Ravens fans becomes a restaurant, becomes a boutique, becomes a thing for young families, and a regular store selling housewares, upscale housewares. That could be looked as a risk, or that could be looked at in the scope of urban development as actually really good investment, because here you have this thing that everyone, Brent mentioned the Urban Land Institute, and every mayor and every economic development agency wants to see more development, more tax revenue, right? And here you've sort of catalyzed it through something that may have happened a decade ago or two decades ago through sort of this sort of more small-scale development through liberalization of pub licensing laws, for instance, right, of being tolerant of this sort of activity, of not having a zero-tolerance policy about people coming into the city to drink alcohol, right? So it may not be an entertainment zone a decade from now, or it may be some kind of hybrid, and that's what you're getting in Philadelphia now. You're getting these sort of hybrid districts where entertainment zones are actually evolving into just urban living. And I think it's an interesting thing, and I think there may be a different paradigm in there. But again, the role of the public sector is still not completely clear, but I've kind of given you, we've discussed some of the things that they can do to sort of encourage this kind of development. And you can call it entertainment, or you can call it just sort of good urban development, because the scale and the size is something that it's good urbanism. That's what we say.
I think that's absolutely true. And in our ideal world, we would find that the city was democratic, pluralistic, densely inhabited, much loved, and widely used. Unfortunately, we're pretty far from that urban ideal in many of our cities in the U.S., and that's it's not necessarily something that can never happen, but we've got quite a ways to go, and I think we also need to accommodate the reality that many of our citizens will continue to live in suburban areas, and that their experience of the city will be, at best, a partial one. And I think if that's the case, we can see that cities will continue to hopefully provide a fulfilling life for people who live in them, but they'll also provide reasons for people who don't live in the city to come and visit the city. And those can be either tourists, or they can be people who live in the region or in rural areas, but who come to the city maybe once a year, once a weekend or so. And that being the case, I think continuing to think about parts of the city being focused on particular types of activities, whether it's offices or entertainment, is not necessarily a bad thing. That's not to say mm-hmm. that we shouldn't, in parallel, focus on efforts, for example, to make grocery stores widely available for people who live in cities. And because of the way development patterns have happened in the past two decades, you sometimes get some parts of cities developing before others. So I lived in Chicago for several years, and we had areas that had many new apartments, fairly high-end apartments, but they didn't necessarily have any grocery stores. And so cities develop episodically and sort of spasmodically, and we sometimes see some things happening before others. In the case of entertainment, we may see that those districts become more well-rounded and that you start to have people living above them, but I think then we'll start to find that other areas of the city that previously we thought of as no-go zones or dilapidated or deindustrialized, you might start to find entertainment coming in there. And I think entertainment is very much like art, although they're not always thought of as the same thing, as being a kind of pioneering use that can activate parts of the city that aren't necessarily that attractive for other uses. So I think, if anything, and I think Dan alluded to this, the complexity of the city will continue to elude us to some extent. And as urban designers and planners, it's our job to not only be laying out the future of these places, but to be watching and listening carefully to pick up on things that are happening that we may not have foreseen. And that's the way Dan and I do our research. We call it experiential research. We go and watch and listen and learn, and we pick up on things that are happening. We try to translate that back into lessons for people who are professionals. And ideally, if we keep working in that way, our cities will become better and better. So I think in closing, Dan and I would say, please remember the small scale and the informal and the local, and you can never go wrong.
Great. Well, you know, I think we're going to have to leave it there. It's already, we're already at 40 minutes.
Okay, very good.
So I mean, it flew right by. So
easy, Scott. I appreciate it.